Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Jay Sridhar. Today, Dr. Rishi Singh of the Cole Eye Institute at Cleveland Clinic joins the program to discuss teaching new fellows, evaluating electronic medical record options as a retina specialist, and the recently successful Retina World Congress inaugural meeting. Remember that you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. We'll be starting a weekly blog there soon, focusing on topics relevant to retina specialists, fellows, residents, and medical students. And soon we'll be adding select excerpted transcripts from some of the most popular episodes. At the bottom are links to subscribe in the iTunes Store as well as Google Play. Please subscribe if you're a regular listener. You can also like our Facebook page or find us in the podcast section of the iTunes Store and Google Play. We're on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and to contact us, click on the Contact Us link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We really love getting feedback both on things we can do better and things we are already doing well. We also appreciate anyone who subscribes via iTunes or Google Play to leave your positive comments in the form of a brief review. Those positive reviews will help us as we continue to grow and expand our scope. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now honored to be joined by Dr. Rishi Singh of the Cole Eye Institute at Cleveland Clinic Foundation. Dr. Singh, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Jay.
So one of the things we always do, Dr. Singh, when we bring retina specialists on the podcast, because we do have a lot of medical students, residents, and fellows who listen on the show, is we kind of talk about why people who are prominent retina specialists ended up in ophthalmology. So was ophthalmology something on your radar when you went to medical school?
I don't think it was, actually. The first time I was introduced to it was actually through a work-study program. I had gotten a small grant to do work-study, and the first opportunity was actually doing washing dishes in an ophthalmology lab. And that's actually the first time I was actually introduced to the concept of basic science research and ophthalmology. And from there, it sort of grew into a more cohesive project. I learned lab techniques as well as worked with the principal investigator a significant amount during my time there. And then I ended up taking a year off medical school to do dedicated research for a year.
And then once you decided on ophthalmology, was retina something that you picked up early, or was it something that you kind of had to flesh out over the course of your residency that was something you wanted to do?
You know, it was funny. One of the people who I trained with at the time said to me, retina was one of the hardest subspecialties in all of ophthalmology. So if you could do that, you could do anything. So I figured I'd do that and see what if I fell back or did achieve that final goal, that at least I would have tried that thing. And actually, I just fell in love with the field. I mean, I think I realized early on that it was, from a research perspective, there's a lot to be contributing to the field. It was a nascent field. There wasn't a lot of drugs available. When I trained, triamcinolone and PDT were avant-garde. Macugen had just come out. And so, you know, there's a whole lot of things that really could have been done and innovated upon, I think, in the field. And so through my experience in doing both clinical research at Cole Eye Institute as well as in my residency program, I kind of started going into the space feeling that retina was the right place for me in the future.
Several of my friends trained at Cole Eye with you and described you as one of their more prominent teachers.
Cool.
I read an interview you did with Retina Today where you talked about how you typically work with first-year fellows straight out of residency. What are kind of the keys to taking someone who's kind of fresh? I mean, we assume that maybe they had a little bit of exposure surgically. They did have some exposure medically in residency, but basically starting fresh with someone and showing them the ropes in the operating room.
Yeah, you know, for me, that's been a real benefit. I like having people who have almost learned nothing to that point, because it's an open slate to really work with them and mold them and develop them into something even great. For lack of a better term, I always pull the short straw and get the person who's straight out of residency, which is totally fine with me. And I like that idea. I like the idea of them, their eyes being wide open, learning, you know, how to start off cases, how to make their lives efficient and organized, and how to sort of be a successful resident. And so it's not always about the surgery when we start off. It's a lot about just life lessons and sort of how you organize your career. And so a lot of times, you know, when the first year start off with me, we'll spend a lot of time working on just how you organize your day, how you prepare for a case. What do you do to note down, you know, the important findings after a case so you can learn from what you did? Keeping a good surgical log and what that means, and keeping a rich material book where you sort of put items that you've learned from the case and then develop them and grow upon them as you go forward. Those are the types of things that I think are really, important keys to success for residents and fellows when they first start off. And so I start by talking a lot about that with them and then work through the process. Surgically, you know, I would say, you know, as a first year, when you start off, you don't do a whole lot. You just sort of watch. And that's exactly what I tell them when they first start out, because I really want them, although they're going to be rapidly pacing and getting more surgery as they go along, I want them to be able to be good observers. Too many times people sit on the side scope and almost fall asleep.
Right.
And that's not an active learner. An active learner is asking questions and noting things down and participating, even if they're an observer for the first case or two.
Let's flip that around, though. What advice do you have for your graduated fellows who are now staffing fellows for the first time in terms of how to keep the fellow involved and also how to avoid complications?
Yeah, so there's a healthy dose of just being able to decide when too much is enough. And, you know, I think there's a fine line between letting the leash go and letting them be able to do what they want to do and then realizing that there's some things they can't do necessarily starting out. So I'll give you an example. So, you know, first thing, you know, when I have residents and fellows come in and work with me the first time, I don't have them start to peel. I have them start to just do the core vitrectomy and the port placement. And once they've shown proficiency with that step, then I then go to the next step. And so it's really, kind of stepping stone where they have to show proficiency in one area before going to the next area. It's not that they're going to be doing the case from beginning to end. And I tell a lot of people when I start off training people that have your fellow start with some building blocks, the prep and the drape and then the patrol car placement. That's really what builds cases and breaks cases if you don't do that properly. And then they might do a core vitrectomy, and then that would be it. And then, you know, at the same time, while the attending is participating, they're also participating in the finer portions of the surgery, which are the more intricate portions.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, I think sometimes people are a little bit cautious to say, hey, listen, this is an attending-only case because there is a severe amount of pathology here that you've never dealt with, and I know you really want to do a TRD today, but the reality of this patient is a one-eyed patient with this pathology and this situation. So I think people shouldn't be shy from saying that, because it's really helpful to be clear with them and be honest with them and say, you're doing this for the sake of the patient and not necessarily for the sake of the educational process. So again, as an active learner, you can learn a lot from a case like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's backpedal to what you said. You know, we spend so much time in meetings or on this program talking about surgical nuances and all the different surgical things. But you touched on something very briefly there that we don't talk a ton about, but it's probably very important for fellows starting a residence interest in retina, which is just prep and draping. What are kind of the mistakes that people make, and what are the things you tell your fellows to do early on to avoid problems later in a surgery?
Oh, there's so many great things to talk about with that. I mean, you could spend almost an hour talking about it. The simplest things are just, you know, placement of, like, for example, the wrist rest. The length that should be from the forehead or from the top of the head is important. Too many times, you know, fellows place the wrist rest at a very high level above that, and so they're working downward, and so they have a very strong angle toward the patient, and they have a harder time peeling because of that. We're supposed to be finesse surgeons. We're supposed to be able to have our hands up in the air and to be touching micrometers of tissue. And I think a lot of times people use a wrist rest as sort of this fallback to say, okay, my hand's got to rest in a certain place. And that impedes them from doing the proper placement of trocars, proper placement of peeling of a membrane, things like that. From the draping perspective, you know, you could create lots of fluid, you know, cuffs or pathways just by draping the patient incorrectly, not rotating the head, and potentially, you know, also have, you know, their own respirations come through. We've seen that before where I'm an OV user, for example, or if you're a Biome user, if you have a lot of people that have, if there's a defect in the drape, that their nasal, you know, respirations come through and actually fog up the lens during the case. And so these are just some simple, really, things that I think people forget about, but it's so important because that's what builds upon being successful in doing that case from beginning to end.
You mentioned tractional retinal detachments.
Yep.
When you're managing tractional retinal detachments, what is your philosophy on pre-op anti-VEGF?
Yeah, so it's a discussion because I think that we obviously hope the patient returns in a timely fashion, and we're lucky because we have a good patient population here where we don't have that sort of county hospital effect where mm-hmm. you prep a patient for surgery, give them an anti-VEGF, and they never show up for surgery for like 4 weeks or 5 weeks or something. So here we have a pretty good population. We typically inject the Monday or Tuesday before a Thursday surgery. 48 to 72 hours is plenty of time before it that you can get the effect of the anti-VEGF in the eye. And then, you know, really, I mean, I don't think there's any harm at even trying a few anti-VEGFs before proceeding to surgery. So I've had patients with really bad TRDs where there's severe neovascularization. And I would sometimes actually with younger patients with more aggressive disease, treat them for 2 or 3 months of anti-VEGF, even though they might have an evolving TRD, because I want to have that arrest of all that neovascularization before I go in and actually do the cutting and peeling and everything else. Because the last thing you want to do is step into an eye when there's active bleeding, active neovascularization everywhere, and you're trying to cut through all those membranes in order to achieve a flat retina at the end of the case.
Right. You, in addition to your activities at the Cleveland Clinic, you're also involved in their medical informatics division. So you have some insight into EMR and its applications. And we went through just like the rest of medicine, the rollout of EMR mandated by the government a few years back. Let's say I'm a practice looking for EMR. I'm a little behind the ball. What are the kind of the keys that I should be looking for when pick selecting a system?
That's a great question. I think there's definitely things to discuss before you even decide which is the right system. First, you know, if you're multi-specialty versus retina only, there are different systems for you out there. If you're looking at a system, you have to decide, I think, on the entry device, more importantly, as well as the software itself. So looking at sort of tablet entry or drawing entry. Many people use scribes, so trying to be honest about whether you use scribes is important too, because you want to have the ability for the scribe to be able to get in and understand the system very well. And I think with regards to the actual EMR selection processors, the products out there are fairly similar to each other. There's not a whole lot of differences. The real question, I think, the real cut point is whether you want to have that data stored at your local site and your own servers in your offices, or whether you think you could achieve a cloud-based approach and have it in the cloud for your servers. That's a big differential, and that really differentiates between many different EMR manufacturers right now, where you put that actual information. And you have to be careful because, for example, if your EMR provider goes out or they go out of business or they decide, you know, they're not going to support ophthalmology anymore, you have to be able to be flexible and mobile. So understanding the ability to move your data from one place to another is going to be key for making sure you're successful in the long term.
And that applies, I guess, to the software you use for imaging systems or image data, because a lot of times it's a separate software package than what you're using for your electronic medical record.
That's correct. Yeah, they use separate software packages requiring separate servers. And again, I mean, that's the question, right? So do you hire somebody to work with you and who does strictly IT stuff, or do you feel comfortable enough that you could potentially have all this cloud-based and nothing that you have to worry about from that perspective with regards to local data solutions or storage?
What do you tell your graduating fellows when they're deciding on academic versus private practice careers? You're at an academic institution that runs very, very efficiently, and the lines have kind of blurred between academics and private practice, though there's still some distinction. So how do you kind of give a fellow advice when they're looking for a job and mapping out the
I think that a lot of times it's not the distinction between academics and private practice, more so it's the distinction between situations of money. And so a lot of times, you know, obviously private practices, they think pay much more money, that they're very much lucrative. said that the practice is, you know, it sounds sexy to be in a plane every day and flying around from office to office and doing all stuff. And the reality of that is that, you know, you can be as successful, if not more successful, from both a financial standpoint and an academic standpoint or a notoriety standpoint, being at a private practice. I would actually say that I'm in sort of a hybrid system. I'm in an academically focused private practice group where we are all physicians under one roof and we're run by physicians and as a physician-led organization. But the reality of our situation is that we have a salary structure. We don't have bonuses. We work to basically achieve the best outcomes. And we don't feel pressured to do an additional surgery because it would be one more notch for our wall or our belt there that day. So we really focus, I think, a lot on making sure outcomes are good and volume is decent. I would say that, you know, I've been, when I first started looking at jobs, I got private practice jobs and offers and things. And the reality was I just couldn't end up seeing myself in that role. I just was being true to myself. I think that's an important thing to say is, listen, if you want to be out in the region or in the country and you feel like you're comfortable seeing patients in your office and, you know, attending meetings and things like that, and that's fine. That's a great opportunity for you. Those are private practice jobs. They're dime a dozen. You can get them all over the place. The really hard ones to find are the ones that have academic potential. Mm-hmm. And even the hardest one to find of all is when you're going to be successful at doing it. So, for example, we have friends of ours that, you know, are in private practice groups, which have a lot of academic focus. And so they'll write papers, they'll do research, they'll even get on podiums and talk about their research they're doing. And those are the really marquee practices. There are a handful of them in the country. They're not many. So academics sort of affords you that ability to do that sort of thing, gives you some carved out time to do so. And the money eventually will come regardless of whether you're in, you know, an academic group versus a private practice group, in my mind, just as long as you're passionate about it.
Your final hat is you're the president of the Retina World Congress, which had its inaugural meeting this year in Fort Lauderdale and was very successful. What was the impetus for starting? We have so many societies, but this one was well received. What was the impetus to start a new meeting?
Yeah, so I think one of the biggest problems in where our focus is in medicine is that we don't think of it as a global market. And right now what we have essentially is we have a very large global marketplace where people are, traveling for health and healthcare all over the world. And I think partially that's driven from the fact that they don't believe that they're qualified people in their area or they're qualified physicians in their countries to take care of them. And so the goal really of Retina World Congress was to, in essence, to increase retinal awareness and retinal disease education and retinal, obviously, technique education across the board with every country. And what we did was we targeted many of the societies that are from those countries to sort of band together and create one meeting. And the meeting was supposed to be more of a collaboration of all those societies together than it was supposed to be, you know, strictly a meet and greet and let's just, you know, have a drink and call it a day. People really came, they contributed. We had 75 different countries represented on the podium, 171 speakers, 1,000 people came to the meeting. So it was definitely put its mark as far as this meeting goes. But I think that the reason why people came and the reason why people aligned themselves with this meeting was because they realized this panel of people that's in front of them represented the room and the people that they were with. So, you know, if you're a guy from China and you're at this meeting, you saw many Chinese speakers at the meeting. You saw, if you're from India, you saw many Indian speakers at the meeting. You were able to kind of assimilate her and also really realize that there was quite a large collaboration from everywhere across the world. And one of the benefits of traveling to different countries like I do for meetings and other people do, and maybe you do, Jay, too, is that you realize that the U.S. sometimes can be behind the times
right. In
some of these techniques that we're seeing. And techniques that, you know, Carl Klaus is doing in Belgium or they're doing in India, or they're doing in China, or they're doing in Japan, are going to become our standard of care in the future. And so having them come and educate us on their techniques, their methods of doing something, or their imaging, you know, facilities or what they're doing, is really where I think, you know, this meeting was needed and beneficial. And yeah, there are a lot of meetings out there. I would say this is a different meeting for a lot of different reasons. I think again for its international flavor and its focus, it was quite different than anything else that we've actually seen anywhere in the world thus far.
I don't want to pressure you because you guys just finished the meeting recently, and it was such a success.
Yeah.
But what are the future plans for Retina World Congress? Will there be another meeting next year? And if so, where will it be?
Yeah, so the next meeting will be actually in March of 2019. It's every 2 years. It's going to be every two-year meeting for the time being, for starters. And then we're going to see how that kind of moves along and what the traction is. We may make it every year at that point. We were quite surprised with the turnout of this one, having over 1,000. Yeah. We were very lucky. I mean, over 1,000 people and people just wanted to contribute. I think at the end of the day, I mean, I'm still getting emails now saying, hey, can we put the program, the people together to do a research project, or can we, do something else, or, where we interact with each other, like in a webinar or something like that, like where we could present like some international perspectives on a certain, surgical technique or whatever. This is a needed, I think, benefit for a lot of people from those countries that want to participate.
Well, Dr. Singh, thank you so much for your time and for joining us. We appreciate all the insights you have, and I think everyone really enjoyed the Retina World Congress. I wasn't able to make it out because I had some call cases to take care of, but from what I heard, you got an awesome turnout, not just in terms of numbers, but in terms of people from leaders from all around the world who were able to come.
Yeah.
I don't know if you mentioned this. Are there plans to make this something that also changes location, domestic and international, over time?
Yeah. One of the benefits of having it in Fort Lauderdale was sort of capturing that vibe from ARVO that many people remember.
Mm-hmm.
And we, for years, went to ARVO, as well as many international people. People felt like it was kind of safe area or safe places for them to travel to. And right now, the plan is to keep it in Fort Lauderdale for 2019. Beyond that, we'll have to see how it goes. It might go to Europe. It might go to South America. It might go to Asia, depending on the interest of people at that point.
Excluding the Retina World Congress, last question. What's your favorite meeting to attend?
It's hard. It used to be subspecialty day, I think, because it was just a really tightly run program. And that was one of the ones that I really looked forward to because it was just overall, I think, great talk, great didactic, good panels. And beyond that, I think, I've been in all the societies now, Retina Society, Macular Society. I think South Society Day still has a flavor to it that's unique and has a marquee to it that's different than the other ones I've been at.
Well, Dr. Singh, thank you so much for joining us. This is Dr. Rishi Singh. He's the president of the Retina World Congress and a faculty member at Cleveland Clinic. And for more information on the Retina World Congress, the website is retinaworldcongress.org. And I'm sure over the next year we'll hear more information about the next meeting in 2 years. Dr. Singh, thanks for your time and have a great afternoon.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Jay.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's retinapodcast.com. You can also like our Facebook page or find us in the podcast section of the iTunes Store on Google Play. We're on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and to contact us, click on the contact us link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks to Louis Kai, our producer, and thank you, the listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the conversations you inspire, the articles you read and publish, and for listening. This is Dr. Jay Schreeder signing off. We will be back next Monday with Journal Club. Good feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.
Take care. Bye-bye.